Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. And what an episode I've got for you today. I recorded this one in lockdown over the internet, and we managed to get the time differences right. And my guest, Tiga, is based in Montreal. And we had a wonderful chat, which you're about to hear, discussing Tiga's life growing up in both Montreal and Goa, and school and all the usual stuff that we talk about on this podcast. And it was a wonderful chat. And as the podcast started to sort of unfold a lot, we had a very similar taste in some early 90s electro indie tracks, which was a lovely way to start to wind down the podcast. And we also chat about Tiga's podcast, which is, an absolute who's who of guests. So I'll just say quickly, thanks to my producer, 76, for producing this podcast. Thanks ever so much to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. And I'm just going to get straight on with it. Just quickly, though, I will say, if this is your first episode that you've listened to of Off the Beaten Track, then go and have a look in the archives, because I've spoken to over 150 amazing creative people, whether they be musicians, DJs, producers, actors, comedians. Go and have a rummage in the vaults and see what you can find. And I do have a Patreon as well, where I put up a unique episode each week over there as well. You can find out all about that at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. But in the meantime, let's get back to business. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with the wonderful Tiga. Sorry to chip in, but I've got another announcement. We have another sponsor. Anyone Can Play Guitar podcast. If you're in a band or an upcoming singer-songwriter, or you just want a little look behind the scenes of how the music business works, this podcast is for you. They interview big-name guests every week, and the lads go in on topics such as how festivals are put together, the role of today's record companies, the importance of touring, marketing, songwriting, the list goes on. And wait till you hear who they've had on. The Killers, Jimmy Eat World, Editors, Frank Turner, Shed 7, as well as loads of record company execs, festival organisers and radio DJs, and loads more. Visit acpgmusic.com or wherever you get your podcasts from. It's the Anyone Can Play Guitar podcast. Go and check it out.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Well, we are recording, and sitting opposite me today via the means of Zoom is Tiga. Hello.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going all right. So you're in, am I correct, Montreal?
Yes, I live in Montreal.
Nice. How is it out there today?
The weather is very nice. It all of a sudden turned really nice about a week ago. Before that, it was miserable, like usual. And when it's miserable, it was a lot easier for everyone to just stay inside, you know. And now that it's beautiful, there's a bit of tension. Montrealers are used to just hitting the streets as soon as it's nice because we have this long winter, you know. So it's a bit strange.
I want to ask you, regarding the kind of quarantine situation that we're all finding ourselves in at the moment, how has that affected you as as a human, and how has that affected you as a creative?
Yeah, obviously it's been on everyone's mind now. It's already, I guess, God, it's almost 3 months already. Well, as a human, I could do, yeah, as a human, I mean, there's ups and downs, you know. I think, I mean, as a touring musician, it's definitely, you know, it's a complete transformation. So sure. that's all done. I don't know. I mean, I've really enjoyed having the time off and the time not traveling. That's not typical. I mean, that's not how everyone feels, but obviously because I'm constantly on the road, been 20 years of traveling all the time. So that's just like, it's been a chance to rest and it's been forced upon me, which never would have happened otherwise.
Yeah.
But obviously it's also pretty terrifying and everything's up in the air, probably no shows for a year. But the shorter answer, I guess, as a human, I find myself enjoying the challenge of it in a way. So it's kind of like, okay, the situation has changed dramatically. How are you going to deal with it? How are you going to turn it into something else? How is it going to change what you make? How are you going to make the best of it, basically?
Was that your mindset right from the beginning? Or I mean, personally, I was a bit more knee-jerk in when we initially got told we wasn't allowed to kind of leave our homes. And I had a kind of week of just not really knowing, you know, what to do, what the plan was. I run nightclubs and so my businesses were closed, and it was like what am I going to do? And it was like, okay. And then for me, after a sort of week, you know, adjusted and then sort of looked at, you know, what positives I can find in this. Like, was you pretty calm with it right from the off?
Yeah, I was, but you know how these things, I mean, these things are so personal. It really, everyone's in a different situation, and it depends, I think, a lot on, as a creative person, I think it depends on where you're at with your career, where you're at with those particular projects, maybe your age, you know, where you live, your home. You know, if you're lucky, everything's completely different if you happen to have a beautiful home or a garden or whatever, versus if you live in a small flat. You know, the little Sure. things like that really change the experience. For me personally, again, my initial immediate reaction was, I think I was just so tired from traveling every weekend for so many years that on some very, very base level, I just was like, okay, this means I have to take a break, and taking a break to do things that I just never had the time to do. So, but you know, those first few weeks were so crazy. So you're scared, you're worried about family members. It was one of those, crazy moments, you know, like, you know, where everyone is freaked out at the same time. And, you know, now already we're talking about it with a certain sense of calm and, but it was pretty trippy there at the beginning, you know?
Okay. Let's talk records. Yeah. So, Tegan, I'm going to ask you for track one, the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro.
Okay. I just have to say one thing. So I do a podcast called Last Party on Earth, and I ask people about records, and I force people to make these brutal decisions, you know? And and I'm really not, I really like watching other people squirm, but it's really difficult to choose these records. And so I guess, you know, I didn't go too deep into the, it's impossible to find the perfect one. You know, there's, so I just picked ones that I love that felt really met the category, but it's a tough ask. Anyway, best intro. I chose, Small Town Boy, which is a song by Bronski Beat. But it's the 12-inch extended version, which has always been one of my favorite songs. And specifically, that 12-inch extended mix has like just a long, super emotional, build up, and it's just, for me, it's just always been, it's very cinematic, and it really puts you in that mood of like, I don't know, I remember being young and hearing that record for the first time, and the music video that went along with it was an incredible video, like a very powerful video. And yeah, it's just one of those tracks that just it builds and builds, and you're just immediately pulled in, like, what is happening? What is this story? You know, and it's quite, and I love it. It's very 80s, obviously, like a lot of my selections.
It is, but, you know, obviously the next question I'm going to ask about an emotional impact, but to just touch on something you said there, when I first saw that video, I'd never seen a video like that before.
No, same.
And I think that was probably my first kind of understanding of homophobia.
Yeah, me too.
I had no understanding of it. I was
same.
Probably like 9 or 10, and it was like, wow. And I will thank you as well, because as a synth pop obsessive, I've never heard the 12-inch mix of that.
Oh my god.
It's incredible.
It just gives it. That's the space you need. Yeah, the video was amazing. It was the first time I really saw that. And I remember there's a few scenes in that video which became really like archetypes for me. They stuck with me. The scene where the father won't shake the son's hand and just slips him some money. Remember that really. Yeah, same. I was probably like 9 years old or something. And I remember being horrified, like so. And then when they chase him, but then also too, I liked that it ended quite happy. You know, it ended like he was going to find his way, and he found his friends, and probably going to London or whatever. You know, like on the way to the big city. And but it's got to be one of the best music videos ever. It's really like a little film, and super powerful, beautiful song. I love it.
And you know, Jimmy Somerville's voice is so unique as well.
Yeah.
It sounds like nothing else. It's glorious. Absolutely.
It's really incredible. Yeah. It's beautiful. And that one too. I mean, when the chords come in right at the beginning, and with that long mix, you get time to like, oh my God. I still get goosebumps. It's funny because I'm one of my jobs, I'm a DJ obviously. And it's funny because I've actually never played that record out. It's one of those ones that, like, in the parties of my imagination, that's always happening. You know, that's being played. But in real life, I don't know why. I don't think I've ever actually played it.
I think if I ever done these questions myself, I would go for an 80s 12-inch mix. I would go for the New York mix of Relax.
Oh yeah,
it just
yeah.
Builds and builds and builds, and it just keeps building. It's like,
and I'm a huge, huge Frankie Goes to Hollywood fan. I think those records. I mean, Relax specifically. It's just, I don't want to say it's underrated because obviously it was like a massive single, but still, in a way, I think they're a bit forgotten. I know what you're saying.
They don't get
their full due as just everything. The visuals, the imagery, the name, the characters, the whole thing was just flawless.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And we'll take. I want to ask you in regards to you've put music out for a few years now, and I want to know how you've approached that and intros as well. When you perhaps first started producing records to more recently, as the way that you approach making music and the intro to hook people changed as people's listening habits have changed in regards to the way that people now listen to music. Can you see where I'm kind of going with this question?
Yeah. Well, most of the records I've made were made really from a DJ, kind of a dance floor angle. So the intros were a little bit more geared to the certain functionality, you know, like thinking really in terms of a DJ. So how much time to mix in, how much time before the first elements change, and mostly, I guess, more rhythmic. The idea of really introducing some theme, like a chorus, or that wasn't really, that I haven't done too much in my music. And the times that I went for a more dramatic intro, then that was, again, that probably wasn't really like the pop formula. It was more like the small town boy formula, which is more just you're going for just mood. You know, this is just going to build and build and build. So I guess it was either a very functional intro to mix in, or in your face, like we're going for it, mood builder, you know, and last track of the night kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess tracks, like you said, though, things have, you know, people are trying to get that. They're trying to get that info to you immediately in a lot of tracks now.
But I guess that, you know, and I expected you to answer similar to that, because being a DJ, I know that music is, you know, that the intros are there, you know, to assist DJs, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I guess in more kind of mainstream pop music, that the mentality is more focused around radio and kind of, you know, hooking people.
I'm not in a hurry. Is I guess the way I build tracks. I'm fine to let things be quite minimal and quite sparse and let them build up. So,
okay. I'm going to ask you for track two to tell me the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please, Tigger.
Okay. Again, this is a tough one. So it's not like the first. Yeah. There were records that obviously made an impact on me, but the one that really, that I really was like, I held close to my chest in that way that you do when you're a kid was, band was Yazoo or is Yazoo. And the song was, Nobody's Diary, which I think is like 1983. So I was 9 years old or 8 years. I was very young and I lived in India at the time. I lived in Goa with my parents. And I didn't have, back then, like I didn't have much like in the way of toys or entertainment. And I had a Walkman and I had a few cassettes, and that track, I just played it over and over and over in my head. And I transcribed the lyrics, and I still have this piece of paper. It's crazy. And I transcribed the lyrics. I mean, I got so many words wrong. It's crazy. I mean, I had no idea what she's really singing about. I had no idea. You know, you're a kid. But that's the beauty of it. You know, I tried to kind of figure out what's happening here. Anyway, I rolled the lyrics up in a little piece of paper, and I wore them around my neck they had these things at the time for I guess, windsurfers. They were like, it was a waterproof kind of amulet. I guess you could put your keys or some money in it. And I kept the lyrics to this song around my neck and walked around. It was like a scene out of the Jungle Book, like no shirt, little kid walking around with his Yazoo lyrics, thinking he had some secret. But it was distinctly emotional, because at that age, I guess as so many kids do, you know, you're just dreaming of, you know, something different, something bigger, something when you're going to be grown up, away from freedom and away from your parents, and, you know, just kind of but in a really nice way, you know, just dreaming like what's the movie of my life going to look like. And I think a lot of the time, pop songs and, they really give voice to that when you're a kid, you know, cause you don't have the vocabulary, you know, so Alison Moyet. And it's funny, I did a tiny bit of research for this podcast, very, very modest amount of research, but I saw that she wrote that song when she was 16 years old. I just found that out today, which is crazy. Cause so I was 9 and listening to a 16 year old girl's love song, you know?
I mean, was that, that was just off the second Yazoo album, I think, wasn't it?
I'm not sure. It was the You and Me Both album. I don't remember if that was... I think it was
Eric's came first, wasn't it? Or was it the other way around?
It's the other way around. I think. Okay. I'm not sure, but I think it's the other way around. I think I know it was on the... because I also really liked that track, State Farm. And I think State Farm was on the other side of the Nobody's Diary single. But mind you, at that time, I was a kid. I had no idea about what was a single and what wasn't. You know, you just, music just somehow it falls in your lap. So
how was growing up in, how old was you when you was in Goa? How old was you when you left Goa?
I was there. I used to spend half the year there and half the year in Montreal until I was about 11 years old, I think. So basically the first 10 years of my life.
How was you getting hold of these tapes, and what were these tapes?
It's funny you asked me that, because I don't remember all of it. I guess some of it must have come from my father. My father had a lot of good records. Some of it would be friends, you know, friends of the parents. You know, somebody would leave a tape somewhere. But what I do remember was there was a hotel in Bombay, in Mumbai. So we would fly to Mumbai first, and then back then you had to take a boat to Goa, it was before they had the flights. And I remember we would stay at a hotel in Mumbai, and it was a little bit like kind of your last outpost of civilization before you kind of went off grid. And I remember they had a little gift shop, like a little bookstore near the lobby, and they sold tapes there. And so I would get like one tape before the season, you know. And I mean, I remember I bought the first Duran Duran album on cassette. I mean, for sure they were bootlegs. I mean, the volume would go like up and down and up. And yeah. For sure, it was some guy around back of the hotel, you know, making them. But I bought. So that's my. Those are the first cassettes I remember buying or having bought for me. I don't the Yazoo one specifically. I don't know. It must have been somehow through the grown-ups.
So, what sort of music was you being exposed to? You know, by your parents and stuff like that. What other stuff was going on?
Well, I was pretty lucky because my parents were into good music, and my dad had good taste and collected records always since he was a kid. And I guess things I was exposed to early, I was pretty into Hank Williams when I was a kid. I was into some country stuff. My dad was very into rock, like Rolling Stones. And I don't know. I would just say pretty general, just good. My dad came from New York, so he grew up listening to radio, and he had pretty good taste. Little Richard and a lot of like rock and roll classics. And then that moved to, you know, the big albums, I guess, the things that were in the background when you're a kid in the 70s are like, you know, Fleetwood Mac and Supertramp. I don't know, you know, Rod Stewart, all the big hits, you know. But there was it was good quality, though. There was good. And my father was very opinionated, which I think was a good lesson for me in that I like that idea of like, I like this, I hate this, you know, even if you're wrong. But I like that mentality to really, you kind of fight for what you think is great, you know.
Was you obsessed in other music at a young age?
Yeah. I got pretty, you know, I think back then it was like, that was how you identified yourself, you know, especially when you moved into school. I mean, that was the number one thing. It's like, well, what do you like? Well, this is what I like. Okay, we can be friends, you know, that's it. Yeah. And it wasn't good. It was really music. I mean, that was kind of who you were, you know.
Well, let's talk school.
For
track three, could you tell me the song that reminds you of your time at school?
Yeah, which one? Did I pick The Cult? Is that what I put on the list there?
You put Cult and Depeche Mode.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I'm going to switch one of them. Okay, I'll try to talk quickly. So I picked... The Cult, She Sells Sanctuary, again, the long version. And this one's a bit strange because I'm not a big Cult fan or, you know, it wasn't even really my style, but I remember distinctly that for whatever reason, that was a big song at the high school, at the school dances. And I used to like go crazy to that.
This high school?
Like junior high school, you know, probably, I guess this is like, so I'm like 12, 13 kind of thing. But I just remember that song, I was like, it was like rebellion for me. So I don't know what it was. I mean, it seems ridiculous to say it now, but I just remember that it was like my song. It would come on at a dance and I would go crazy. And like, you know, it's quite embarrassing now to think about, but it was the first time, one of the first times where I identified like power in music, you know, like, so, which is kind of lame that's your punk experience, which is She Sells Sanctuary, but it's a great song, you know. And also again with the intro, and it was fast, and I remember again the video, like I thought Billy Duffy looked so cool, and
man,
you know, I
don't, so
you know,
cool.
And the bassist, I don't know the bassist name, but I remember the bassist had this crazy haircut, and I never really went for Ian Ashbery's kind of Jim Morrison stuff. That was a little too much for me. But
well he got to kind of sort of tick that box, didn't he? I don't know if you know, but he ended up fronting the Doors for a while, didn't
he? Yes, I heard that.
They done them tours. I actually saw that as well. That was quite crazy. But to touch on She Sells Sanctuary a little bit, I think that if I put that on now, that record hasn't aged in any way, shape, or form. It still sounds so fresh.
I put it on this morning. I was kind of playing drums, and I was like, you know, it's got a real, it's definitely got a power to it. I also like too that, you know, the 80s were a strange time where you could have these weird hit records, you know. I think it's quite odd that was a big international hit record, you know. And then I picked, so I'm going to take out Depeche Mode, forget them.
Okay.
I love them, but I'm replacing that with, in my last year of school, I went on, believe it or not, because I'm quite a little guy, I went on a rugby tour of England, Scotland, and Wales. I went to an all-boys school, kind of like an English-style school. We had uniforms and stuff. And we went on tour, and we hit London in, I guess it was 1990. And everywhere in London we went, there was this song playing, this Beats International, Dub Be Good to Me. You know this one? This I think it was Norman Cook, or
it was Norman Cook and the vocalist Lindy Layton, as he's Lindy, a really good friend of mine.
Oh my god! I had like a crush on her because like.
Oh my god!
Because she,
I had the biggest crush on her.
Okay, perfect. So because we had never, so we roll up in London. We had no idea, and everyone's wearing bomber jackets and big British knights, and this song's playing everywhere, and it was really like that was my first experience of like, okay, shit, there's cool stuff going on, and so that that's just a very specific memory of last year of school. In, you know, constantly that song. Of course, I went to buy the record at Tower and Piccadilly or whatever it was. And that was just the theme of everything, you know, that one song. Yeah, Lindy, the video was great. And the Tank Fly, Boss Walk, Jam, Nitty Gritty. You know, that.
What an intro.
Yeah, it's an amazing intro. I have no idea what it means, but it's a great intro. I can't believe I just said that.
Yeah, she's great. She's coming down this podcast, and
oh wow, that's crazy.
And it was bananas too. I sat there in her front room, and it was like, if someone would have told the 15-year-old me I'd be sitting opposite Lindy
exactly.
Lane in her front room, would have blown my mind, mate. Would have literally knocked my British Knights clean off my feet.
I know it's so strange how that happens. It's those experiences, how it does come full circle. One little tiny thing that's an anecdote about that day. I just remembered I was into a band called Alien Sex Fiend. I don't know if you ever heard of them.
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. So I was really into them for whatever reason when I was a kid at that same time. And I went to the same record store. I bought the Beats International, and I don't know. And some guy working in the shop, like I got to talking to him, and he's like, "Well, I'm a roadie for Alien Sex Fiend. Would you like to come to Nick Fiend's house out wherever in London?" Like, and I was like, I looked like I was like 10 years old, and I remember being like, oh my God, I don't think I can. But it was funny. Again, just like a real brush with London, you know, all your fantasies of what London's like when you're a little kid from Canada, you know,
that don't happen, but what happens? That's incredible, man.
I know. I couldn't. And he looked the part, and you know, hey, listen, I mean, it's no mystery to you, but London was always and has remained just such an incredible place for music. It's England in general, it's wild. It just doesn't stop.
Okay. So, I mean, if you go off to school, like, did you enjoy it?
School?
Hmm.
I don't know. I mean, it was okay.
What did you want to be?
My main sense of school was I kind of wanted it to be over. You know, I just always felt I always had my own projects. I was very motivated, but I felt school was in the way. You know, I was like, I couldn't wait for it to be over. I didn't really know what I wanted to be. I kind of vaguely wanted to be an architect at one point. I did go to university. I studied history, but I dropped out right at the end because rave, I was becoming so just obsessed with DJing and parties. And I never had a clear definition of what I wanted to be. I was quite immature. I had no idea. Until then, I just wanted to get into music and techno and stuff. When I discovered rave culture, that was all. I completely dropped any half-baked ideas of being an architect. I don't even know what it was.
Sure, you
know?
There was no...
I was just lucky. I was very, very lucky. I think it's the luckiest thing that happened to me in my whole life is just... I think if you're very young and you get that focal point, if you can decide on something that you're passionate about when you're young, you can be quite unstoppable, you know, because when you're young, you just have this, you have a lot of kind of courage and energy. And so I was lucky. There was a lot of focus when I was really young, and it was a good thing.
And where was that when you've been exposed to rave culture? Was that in Montreal?
Well, at the beginning, I mean, I had seen parties in Goa growing up, which were these kind of weird, strange, hippie beach parties. So I guess that was a bit in the back of my mind. Specifically, the first time was, I mean, I picked up some magazines and some, I had a little bit of an idea what was happening, but it was really the first time was I went to a club in Montreal called, it was called Crisco, and it was like the first like ecstasy club in Montreal. It was more of a kind of gay house music club, but that was the beginning for me of, like, okay, yeah, I want this, you know, I want to be involved in this. This is what I want, you know. And seeing a DJ for the first time too, you know, really, I was like, I want to be that guy. Like, that's what I'm not really sure, but I want to be there. That's what I want to be doing, you know.
Hello, I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off The Beat and Track Podcast, and you can listen to all the songs, because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
In each episode, so you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. You mentioned Tower Records earlier. So for track four, I'm going to ask you the first song you remember buying from a record store.
Okay, well that's easy. I have a specific, so two categories, with my parents' money and with my own money. With my dad, I went to a record store in Montreal. My dad and I bought Blondie, Parallel Lines, the album. But that's super young. That's like, I might have been like six or something. But I do remember. And I remember...
What attracted you to that? The cover?
Blondie. Blondie attracted me to that. Yeah, the cover and Blondie. And I actually remember that on the back of the record, there were little still photo images from, I guess, either some of the videos. For the tide is high, I think, if memory serves, there was a little photo that I thought it looked like Darth Vader. Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm just making this up, but I'm pretty sure there's like, I thought it was Darth Vader. I thought maybe, right. So between Blondie, her look, and maybe a connection to Darth Vader, I was like, this looks great.
Ticks all the boxes, right?
Ticks all the boxes, exactly. But with my own money, which is, I guess, the real answer, I remember I went with a friend. Went to, I don't remember which record store. This is in Montreal. We took the bus, and this is in, I guess, grade six. So I guess I'm 11, and I bought 2 7-inch singles. I'm only going to tell you one because it's the less embarrassing of the two.
But I'll tell you both.
This is, get it. So the more embarrassing one was Eye of the Tiger by Survivor.
Well, nothing to be embarrassed about.
I'm a kid, and it's whatever. I guess it's not embarrassing. That's how it works. You know, when you're a kid, you buy a big hit, you know. But, and then I bought this record called Send Me an Angel by Real Life. I don't know, which is, I guess, not a particularly famous 80s track, but definitely for me, that was kind of the template for a lot of the music I ended up loving, you know, very just classic synth pop, you know, little.
That's the first I'd never heard that track.
Okay.
And so I went and sort of explored them a little bit today.
I think they might be Australian. Oh,
they are.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know, okay? I didn't know. As an 11-year-old,
incredible
had I known.
Incredible haircuts.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly. But, you know, I think when you're a kid, that period, that 80s period, you know, it was all very, it was quite futuristic. It was very romantic. It was like everyone looked so fancy and polished. Yeah. And depending on where you grew up and what you had, that really seemed like it was an escape. And the sounds were futuristic, you know?
Yeah.
They were these weird synths. And anyway, it was exciting.
Okay. Well, this is an interesting question to ask you. The song that soundtracked your years in Clubland, I mean, your years in Clubland are ongoing, right?
It's a life sentence. Yeah, I laughed when I saw the question. I'm like, I don't, you know. Well, I laughed because I imagined, you know, there's some people that get asked that question and they think back to like, oh, I had a three-year period where I went crazy and it was Underworld, Born Slippy, and, you know, whatever it is. But
someone literally said that last week.
Of course, you know, it's that's what, you know, for most people, that is, it's a chapter in their life. So the what's amazing is that it's not a chapter in my life. It's just the never-ending weekend, which, to tie back to the quarantine, why that's such a crazy thing to not be. These are the first, since I'm 17 years old, it's the first time I haven't been in a nightclub or a party for more than 2 weeks. You know, so
completely the same.
You know, so it's just it's thousands of parties in a row. You know, so the one I will pick is the one that really introduced me to rave, to which was Alternate, the guys who wore those masks, and the track was called Infiltrate 202. Again, I remember the record store. It's funny, it's so nice with record stores, you remember where you were. So there was this was a big HMV or something in Montreal, and they had like a little back room with some imports at the time. They were called Imports. Yeah. Oh God. And I bought an import CD, some techno compilation, and it was the second track or the first track on it. And it blew my mind. I mean, I listened to that record hundreds of times, and people often say like a record changed their life, but this actually changed my life. I mean, it was from that moment on till today, it's just been never ending, whatever sequence of parties and DJing and related to that feeling. That was a big kind of, it had that real UK emerging acid house, warehouse, ecstasy, just the whole thing. And they wore those suits and they had the masks and they were talking about a party in a car park or so. I don't know. It was just awesome. That
they were from not far from where I live. And
are they from Sheffield? No.
Yeah, no, they were from
Stoke.
Yes.
I don't know where it is. I've just seen it in writing.
Stoke's actually sort of further up towards the Midlands, where I live in Essex. Like the London is surrounded. You probably know this. Anyway.
Oh, you're from Essex. Prodigy are from Essex, right? Liam's from Essex.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. I was literally last week, I was chatting on here to Nick, who set up XL, about rave culture, and he was Kicks Like a Mule.
Oh, cool.
So we was chatting about this because the road that surrounds London and where I live is the M25, which I'm sure you've driven on when you've been touring over here. And that was the epicenter of rave culture, was like these service stations on the M25 where you'd pull up, you'd get your little sort of message, and it was like, right, let's go and find the field. And it was. And Alternate would be at all the raves. And I mean, I'll say this with the greatest respect, but when this lockdown happened and the first time I went out and everyone was like wearing these masks, I was like, it's fucking Alternate, man. Everyone looks like Alternate.
Yeah, I have my old one. I made one when I was a kid. You know, I copied the, used fluorescent marker, and I put Vicks inside. And anyway,
brilliant. Funny. Imagine you! I'm just picturing you at a rave with that on, man, with your little thing around your neck with your Nobody's Diary lyrics in it.
Yeah. Oh my God! I had the whole. It's funny how it really, it doesn't, it's only after a certain amount of time you look back and you realize like you were a kid. I was a kid, you know, but yeah, I had the whole, I think we went in North America when rave came over here. So it's a few years later, I guess it's 92 that it really starts here. And we took the fashion thing a little bit. It got a bit ridiculous, you know, the UK kept it a little bit. I think it always stayed a little bit cooler. It got a bit cartoony over here. It was pretty funny.
It got pretty cartoony here,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, it got
man.
Pretty cartoony. Yeah, yeah, of course.
Like, I mean, what about, like, did Acid House get out there?
Well, I guess I don't know about New York and stuff. For here, Acid House, I guess it got into the clubs, I guess, like, maybe 90. I was too young. I wasn't going out. Yeah. We had a big disco scene. You know, we had a huge disco scene. And so house music in the early form was pretty big in Montreal. And then I guess it started to move a little bit towards acid house. But I don't think it really started till like 92. So it was a bit behind.
Okay.
We always had good parties, though. It was always Montreal was always a good party city.
So was you already sort of, around that time, was you starting to kind of cut your teeth as a DJ?
Yeah, I started, well, you know how it is. It's probably the same for a lot of us. You know, it was so DIY at that time. You know, you're like, okay, I'm a DJ, and you start by playing for your friends, and you sell some mixtapes, and you throw a party. And yeah, I started in 92. Started DJing in 92. And I actually, because I was kind of one of the first here, I started to get pretty big shows pretty quickly, because it was like a very, you know, we represented, me and all my friends, we were like the new generation, and it was a big, so very quickly, I mean, within a year, I was playing really, really big parties, and I was kind of learning in public.
Was you confident?
I was annoyingly confident as a person. Jesus, you wouldn't have wanted, especially with regards to all that. I was like an evangelist. I was like a nightmare. I mean, I was just so preaching to everyone about techno music being the future and blah. Yeah, I was really intense, very confident.
Driven?
Very, extremely. I was, I opened a record store, then I opened a nightclub, and I was throwing huge parties by the time I was 18. You know, I had backpacks full of money and up all night. I mean, it was just the whole, I was very much the entrepreneur as well. But confident as a DJ, I was confident in the tracks I was playing. I was confident that I was onto something. Technically, no. Technically, it took a while. And I remember the first shows, I was very nervous, and you know, I think technically as a DJ, it took me a while. I distinctly remember praying. I'm not a religious person, but I remember, you know, this is like the kind of thing you do when you're a kid. I remember like, please God, whoever, it's probably the only thing I ever asked from God in my life, let me be able to beat mix. I was like, I remember actually in my bedroom, like, and I wasn't even that young. I'm like, please, that's all I want. Just let me be able to beat mix. Anyway, be careful what you wish for. As far as getting one wish, I don't know if that's the one you really want. I got that.
It served you well, mate.
Yeah, it served me well.
Track 6, a favorite song from an artist from your home county.
Yeah, this one. Okay, so the artist is an easy choice because Leonard Cohen is in my all-time top three. He might be all-time number one. Well,
he's in my three.
Yeah, he's in my three for sure. I mean, I have a constant. There's a constant. I don't know why I pit them against each other. That's stupid, childish. But him, Prince, Bowie, and Dylan are just duking it out all the time. But the one that I really love Leonard Cohen, and he's from Montreal. He grew up like a block away from me. We have very similar, well, I guess the similarity ends there. I wasn't into him at all as a kid. It started maybe 10 years ago. But yeah. We have some family friends, and he actually sent me a birthday card before he passed away. And we're very much same community, and he knew my dad vaguely. He knew my mom kind of, but we have a lot of friends in common. Anyway, he's really like, he's from the same part of Montreal. It's quite a small place. So anyway, I just rate him as a man and as a poet and as a thinker. He's just such a beautiful person, and his songs are just incredible. So for me, they're more than songs. I guess they're like, I don't know. They're like, they really help you along in life. You know, you just, they're like, and they never run out of meaning. And he's so, oh God, I have a book, which is all his interviews collected. It's like 500 interviews or whatever. And I just read them. I read them how some people, you know, those prayer beads that some people use. For me, it's like you just listen to Leonard talk and he never puts a foot wrong. He's so patient and wise. And if I had to choose a song, I just go with Suzanne, which is, even though it's kind of one of the more popular ones, I'm always trying to be a bit cooler. Like, oh, I know the underground, but
there's a reason it's popular.
There's a reason. Exactly. And it has actually brought me to tears on occasion. And I saw him a bunch of times in concert and I mean, he's just, So I think Leonard Cohen's one of those things where a lot of people have an idea of him as whatever, something. And a lot of people kind of don't listen to it or they wait too long, but it's always there for you at some time in your life.
Exactly that.
You know what I mean? Like at some point you can get into it and it'll pay big dividends.
In the UK, in the early 80s, there was a TV show, a huge TV show called The Young Ones, and it was just this landmark alternative comedy. I don't know if you've ever heard of it or
no,
but it was huge, and there was this running joke in it that, you know, things were as boring as Leonard Cohen, and that was like all I knew about Leonard Cohen was like, oh God, this guy must be so boring. And then when I first got my heart broken when I was about 16, 17, someone went to me, listen to this, and it was, hey, that's no way to say goodbye.
Oh, that's in my top three. That's
and I was like, fuck. Why have I not been listening to Leonard Cohen? And then that was it. Like the floodgates opened and it was like,
I know that song, Our Steps Will Always Rhyme, you know, like,
oh, yeah, mate.
I know it's crazy. But sometimes I think it's actually kind of nice because you wait until you're ready in a way. And then when you're ready, he's ready. He's got you. He's got you covered, you know? So there's a bunch. I mean, I could pretty much pick any of his songs, but actually Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye is top five for sure.
Yeah, and it's anyway, a heavy record.
But yeah, okay. Anybody listening, just go grab a couple of Leonard Cohen records.
Yeah, you will not be doing the wrong thing if you do that. Mm. It's there's so much glorious beauty to be had there. Tiga, I'm going to ask you to play DJ one more time.
Sure.
And I want you to tell me a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
Okay. Yeah, this is a good question. What did I put on my notes here?
There was two.
Kate
Bush track.
Oh, yeah. There's a Kate Bush record called Under the Ivy, which it's one of my favorite songs ever. And I don't know why, I haven't come across it that often, not as often as I think it should. You know, everyone knows Running Up That Hill or Hounds of Love. I mean, Kate Bush is just phenomenal. She's just a force of nature. And that song, Under the Ivy, is one, I just think it's just so beautiful. And I get teary-eyed again. But I just haven't heard that many people mention it, I guess. But I wanted to switch over to... there's a band called Fingerprints. Do you know this band?
I didn't, but I do know.
Okay.
Fingerprints with a Z, isn't it?
Yes, with a Z, exactly. So, which I guess at the time was a wild idea. But there's a band called Fingerprints. They're Scottish. I think they're from Glasgow. And this is just one of those weird... So this is a record I got from my dad. And is a track called Wet Job. I don't know what that means. But it's a band that I just... It's one of those things where, like, I've never really met someone else who loves them. I've never met someone else who is really familiar with them. And I think they're fantastic. Like, they have an album called Beat Noir, which the whole album's amazing. And this track I always loved, and I always thought they were really... It's in a genre that I'm not... It's a little bit like...
It's a bit post-punk, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yes, it is kind of post-punk, and which is not usually my forte, whatever, but I love them. And I've always thought this is a good example of how, you know, you find some strange band, you get quite attached to it. And then sometimes you have no idea if they're even popular or not, but I think they're going. I want to give an honorary mention to Pop Will Eat Itself because
We can talk about them for as long as you want.
Cause I was obsessed with Pop Will Eat Itself. And outside of the UK, I think they're quite unknown, actually. I mean, they're really, and it was really, they have like their own vibe going. You know, it was quite, but they were really influential on me. Like the graphic design, that was the first time I was exposed to the Designers Republic. They were way ahead on all kinds of, the production was incredible. They were really like so many interesting samples. And so there's a lot of, I think they're just chronically underrated.
Massively underrated.
They're just, you know, and I was always, and it's what, I think the reason is because there's something about them. They're a little bit goofy in a way. Like, they don't have the cool factor locked down. So I think a lot of people.
It was very cartoony, their look.
Yes.
You know, and it's lots very of, kind but of, then so many bands of that era were. It was lots of, you know, lots of dreadlocks, colored, you know, t-shirts and stuff. And
yeah, and some of it hasn't aged so gracefully. I mean, it's a tough sell now saying that there's like a white English guy with dreads and he's kind of speed rapping. And, you know, it's there's some things that are tricky. But anyway, I think a really underrated band. And what is it? The album Cure for Sanity is incredible. And they also had some weird kind of B-side records that were, there's one called The Fuses Have Been Lit, I think, which is really beautiful and just really smart use of sampling. And yeah, and I think the guy Clint Mansell went on to be quite a big producer. Like a, he's huge in movies and soundtracks and stuff.
Yeah, huge. Yeah.
So I was always a big. Am I a poppy? Is that what they're called?
The poppies.
We're the poppies. Yeah, we're the poppies. Yeah, so
and
I
think
them.
They were really important, and I think that kind of moment that went from the Prodigy experience to Duty Generation, I think Pop Will Eat Yourself had a big impact on Liam Hallett around that time. Mm.
Yeah, it's for whatever reason, there's a little chunk of UK music like EMF and Jesus Jones and stuff. You barely hear, nobody talks about it. But
I do, Tiger. I've had them both on my podcast.
You're the first like, person I met.
I was speaking to James from EMF last week. And Ian from Jesus Jones the week before.
Okay.
That period of music is so ignored.
Yeah.
Because in England, we go from 1989 Hacienda Stone Roses, then we go straight to either grunge in 92 or we go straight to Britpop in 95. Yeah. That period where electronic music fused with guitars in them kind of early 90s with Poppy's EMF.
Yeah, it's
Jesus
so true.
Jones,
it's so true.
It gets ignored.
And in England too, it's like, yeah, I mean, you know, you have the bands like Stone Roses and Stone Roses, obviously. I mean, there's certain ones that really get a lot of airtime. I mean, deservedly. But yeah, you know what? Well, you're probably the only person I'll ever meet where there's any relevance to even say this, but I, at an EMF concert in Montreal, I stage dove. I was the first one up on the stage, which when I was, whatever, when I was 16 or something, it was quite a big, it might have been the first time I'd actually been on a stage.
Yeah.
It was, it felt really good. I liked it.
Wonderful. Yeah. All right. Well, look, we spoke about clubbing earlier, and I mean, you know, it's a real privilege for me to speak to you today, and there's so many other DJs I'd love to speak to, but they've all spoke to you already, and your podcast, man, it's a who's who, right?
Yeah, it's been well. It's yeah. I mean, I've had a lot of big DJs. And I've really enjoyed it. I started the podcast. I mean, I have to say I'm up and down on podcasting. I mean, there's some I don't know if you feel like this. Sometimes I do it and I'm like, yes, this really feels great. And there's other times I'm like, what am I doing? Just talking endlessly. Like, you know, like, I guess it's cause well, I just talk a lot and I don't always like to hear my own voice so much, you know, but the show's been going really well and I've really enjoyed it. And, you know, it's a simple kind of framework. I really based it a bit around Desert Island Discs, which I really love.
God, I'm a bit guilty of that as well, man.
She is the best. What's her name? Kristen Young or Christy Young?
Kristy Young.
She is.
Yeah.
I think she's like, for me, like her, Conan O'Brien, Stephen Colbert, like these, they're like killers, but she is so good. Anyway.
Kirsty's not doing it anymore.
I heard she got sick or something, right? Or
I don't actually see it. Lauren Laverne's doing it now. And,
yeah.
And yeah, she's still good, but Kirsty Young's voice, oh man.
I had trouble. I had some kind of weird allegiance that grew between me and Kirsty Young. Like, I had to stop listening.
I don't think you're alone there, man.
No. But anyway, yeah, the podcast is a lot of fun, and people really seem to like it. And I'm enjoying, I've talked to Pete Tong. I just talked to Richard Russell this week, Benji B, Carl Cox, Kolsch, Boys Noise, Errol Alkin. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And like, you know, the podcast format is amazing when you give people a chance to talk who never really talk. They never get to talk, or they never get the time to explain it. And behind every DJ or some DJs is an actual real human being. Yeah. if given the chance to communicate, you know, and it's been fun.
Tigger, I did not think when speaking to you today, I'd be talking about alien sex being a stage diving as a poppy at an EMF concert.
I'm still looking for like a Pop Weed Itself t-shirt. There's so many things I never got. I wanted it all, and I lived in Canada and we had nothing. I was a member of the Alien Sex Fiend fan club. It's an actual fan club. I have zines in my house. I think I have a badge and a button. And I remember I sent a $5 Canadian bill in the mail. Like, I sent a bill in the mail. Yeah.
Oh,
anyway,
wonderful.
If you have any, I got any merch, send it my way.
I've got a long sleeved red Pop Will Eat Itself, and it's the sleeve. The artwork is for DEFCON 1, I believe.
Oh my god, I need it.
It's pretty badass, man.
I need that. Does it still fit you? Have you grown at all? Because I haven't grown.
The thing is, like, everything you wore back then was like three sizes too big anyway.
I know.
So it's probably like a skinny fit on me now. But Tigger, thanks so much for your time, man. It's
Thank
been
you.
An absolute joy chatting.
I really appreciate it. I really liked it. And it's a really nice, it's great to meet someone where you like a lot of the same records. It's fun.
Absolutely. Okay, man. Take care, buddy.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye.
There you go. What a great chat that was. And yeah, when we pressed stop, we carried on talking and about some of that early 90s indie stuff and the live scene in Montreal and some of the shows that Tigger went to. Yeah, absolutely wonderful chat. Hope you had as much fun listening to that as I did recording it. Thanks again to Tigger for giving up his time and chatting. Go and check out the podcast, obviously. And once you've listened to all of his, then go and have a rummage in the archives of Off the Beaten Track and see if there's anything you might have missed or not listened to there as well. Best thing you can do, just subscribe. Subscribe to both of them. And then every time you look at your phone, you might get a little surprise, which is a brand new episode just popping up on your listening device. All right, I'm done. I've been speaking too long. I will be back next week. And if you can't wait that long, go and check out the Patreon, because there's a bundle of stuff never released to the masses over there. You can find out about all of that at www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. I'm done. Stay safe. See you soon. Bye-bye. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out, because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year, and they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands, alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So, go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast, and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk. Do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15. BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk. Official sponsors of Off the Beaten Track podcast.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.